I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. Welcome to an American conversation, as we say, with global attitude. We've had several takes lately on Cuba, history, life today, politics at the very end of Fidel Castro's long reign. This round, we're talking about the related power of Cuban culture to compel the world's attention, most especially its music. Our guest, Ned Sublett, wrote one of my favorite books of the new century titled Cuba and Its Music, From the First Drums to the Mambo. And it's a story that goes on to new glory since the Mambo. Ned Sublett, welcome back to Open Source.
Thank you, Chris.
Take us back almost to the first drum and explain, if you can, briefly, why this universal resonance of the genius mix in Cuban music.
Well, Cuba was the first great capital of music in the hemisphere, and it remained a great capital of music in the hemisphere well into the 20th century until it dropped out of the world's notice. But music continued there, of course, even though the world was no longer listening, and even though the music in Cuba transformed after the revolution in 1959. Cuba was, well, you know, Cuba took more Africans than all of North America. Africans in Cuba. There were 1,000 black people in Cuba by 1527. This is already in time to influence music in Europe. Music goes back from Cuba to Europe. You have the saraband of the Baroque dance suite. Well, sarabanda is the Congo god of iron and war. This name traveled from Congo to the New World, back via Havana to Sevilla and up into Europe, already in the 16th century. The function of Havana, because it was the center of the Spanish shipping empire, Havana was where the silver was sent back from Mexico and Peru to Sevilla. It was a service economy from the beginning and always had a lot of dancing and music going on. And it was kind of the melting pot for the entire Afro-Creolized world of the Spanish Empire at the time when the Spanish were the only significant colonizers in the New World. So from the very beginning, it had a lead. It was always had a strong Afro-Cuban culture from the 16th century on. By the early 19th century, Havana had become a very rich place as the west part of Havana was planted in sugar. Most of the slaves brought to Cuba came after 1790. And Cuba was the last place to import Africans. After 1850, they were the only country in the hemisphere still bringing – well, they weren't a country yet. Technically, they were a colony. But they were the only place in the New World still importing Africans. By then, they were plunking up whole villages out of Oyo and dropping them down in Matanzas. Slavery didn't end in Cuba until 1886. So bottom line, when somebody like Mongo Santa Maria was born in Havana in 1922, it had only been 30-some years since the end of slavery. There were still people born in Africa who were the elders of his barrio. Mongo's grandfather came from the Congo, so the African tradition is very strong in Cuba. Also, the Spanish never prohibited the use of ancestral drums. They had some organizations called cabildos, so behind the doors of the cabildos, the ancestral religions could be practiced. I personally have been to representations of 5 different African nations and their religions in Cuba. Congo, Carabali, Arara, Ganga, Lukumio, Yoruba. All of these played on ancestral drums, singing in ancestral languages, with believers in the religion. This is today, not counting all the Creolized Cuban traditions. So Cuba's been a powerhouse of music from the beginning of the colonization of the New World.
It's fascinating to hear your version of what we sort of know, that Cuban black people retain a connection with Yoruba and other African roots, both musically and religiously and otherwise, as African Americans don't.
The history is quite different. By the end of slavery, people in Anglo-American territories were already African-Americans for generations, spoke English. Their religions had been taken away. The British and the Anglo-Americans were militant about prohibiting the drum, so they were not allowed to play drums. The classic African-American instrument of slavery days were the banjo and the fiddle, instruments that dominated in the Senegambia. As you can see, there's quite a different history. And sort of the point of collision between these two great worlds, which have very different musics. African-American music and Afro-Cuban music are very, very different. The point of collision, sort of the valve, was New Orleans.
This came up not long ago in a conversation with Alex Ross about his book, The Rest is Noise, which can be summarized as how the world capital of music moved from Vienna in the Mozart through Mahler days to Los Angeles. And I would have said, in fact, it really
I'm sorry, Alex.
I was going to say it moved
from... The world capital of music was Havana. Vienna was not the world capital of music. I'm sorry. It was maybe the world capital of a kind of music.
It had a pretty good run between Haydn and Brahms and Webern and Berg.
But meanwhile, you had Havana. You had a whole other thing growing in the New World. You had the entire Afro-Atlantic world already active. The problem is that it did not have a notational system, and everything before the invention of recording is prehistory. So we don't know what Congo Square sounded like.
In our lifetimes, Ned Sublett, explain the power of Cuban music in all of our heads. And I don't know exactly where you want to start. I always start with Dizzy Gillespie bringing Chana Pozo into his band.
Well, in terms of, as I say, Cuban music was influential far beyond the boundaries of the island well before the 20th century. In the 19th century, certainly that was the case. All you have to do is look at the work of Luis Moro Gottschalk, the greatest 19th century United States composer, to see the influence of Cuba there. The 20th century, I would start it really with the beginning of, by the time you have electrical recording and sound film, in 1930, the peanut vendor, Don Aspiaso, which was one of the biggest hit tunes of the century. One of the most prominent instruments on it is the maracas. Right? Now, no African-American band leader played maracas, right? This is not a North American instrument. But, you know, when you listen to the drum kit, the hi-hat in rock and roll that we take for granted today is going... Drum kits didn't have hi-hats in 1930. They weren't doing that yet. This comes in, the very drum kit, which we take as one of the basic American things, develops in response to the more polyrhythmic texture that was coming in from Cuba. And certainly already in the Peanut Vendor, you can see this three-chord thing. This loop of three chords, right? Jazz didn't do that. Jazz played chord changes, song forms, 12-bar blues, but it didn't loop 2-bar 1-4-5 over and over. That was one of the basic constructive devices of rock and roll. Thump, 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 thump. It comes straight out of Cuban music. In the 60s, I argue that the cha-cha-cha is one of the basic rhythmic templates for rock and roll.
Make the argument. Remind me.
Well, there are a couple of very easy and well-documented places to make it. One, of course, is Louie Louie. Dum dum dum, dum 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 dum. That lick is lifted right out of the recording of El Loco Cha Cha by René Tossette. song was originally called Amar en el Loco, which goes, well, dum 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 dum. Louie Louie was literally a cha-cha-cha, and it was played for kids who wanted, it was played by a band called Ricky Rilera and the Rhythm Rockers, as told in Dave Marsh's wonderful book about Louie Louie, in L.A. in the 50s, who wanted to dance cha-cha-cha. Richard Berry, an African-American born in Louisiana who had moved as a child to Los Angeles, turned it into the song Louie Louie, but kept that two-bar lick that you could just jam on and extend as long as you wanted. This is the groove, you know. You could just, you didn't have to keep playing the changes to a song. You could just lay on these two, on these three chords all night. Almost the same time, just a little bit later, Richie Valens, playing for, again, Mexican kids in L.A. who wanted to dance cha-cha-cha because cha-cha-cha was the hype in those days, takes a Mexican song, Jarocho La Bamba, but plays it as a rocked-up cha-cha-cha. When they record it, the head of Delphi Records hires Earl Palmer, probably the most recorded drummer in American history, who had recently relocated there from New Orleans. Earl Palmer was the guy who played on all the Fats Domino records, all the first generation rock and roll classics out of New Orleans. And Earl Palmer had taken a down low vacation, stowing away on a United Fruit Company steamer to Havana in 1941. Earl Palmer knew very well what all this was about, and you can hear on La Bamba, he's playing on the woodblock all the time to literalize it for North American audiences. One, two, cha-cha-cha. Okay, jump forward to 1965 and the Stone Satisfaction. Hey, 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 two, cha-cha-cha. That's what I say, do cha-cha-cha, one, two. Because, bottom line, what African-American music was doing in the 30s, 40s, and 50s was shuffle time. However you want to, you know, exemplify it, which comes, I believe, from that feel comes, I believe, from the Senegambian region of Africa. Senegambians were never brought to Cuba. Cuban music never swings. Cuban music plays straight eights. By the 60s, this dominates rock and roll. So the influence of Cuban music is quite profound in American popular music.
I love your take, and I love the band you brought, Ned. This is fascinating.
Can I give you another example?
Sure.
I just noticed this the other night. I haven't even thought of it. Duke, 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 Duke of Earl, 2-3, cha-cha-cha, 2-3. You know, there it is.
This is great. Two other names we have to deal with. Chano Pozo.
What's the other one?
Mongo Santa Maria.
Chano and Mongo.
We should listen to the eternally magical Manteca with Chano Pozo and Dizzy Gillespie's band. Swing jazz, beautiful, dizzy.
And that was added to it. because they feared that just having the one thing over and over would drive everyone mad, because the idea of a simple one-chord groove tune was not thinkable yet. So the bridge was added to it. And you can hear on Manteca that Dizzy's guys aren't completely comfortable playing this groove yet. Chano showed them how to play the Afro-Cuban style. And it took a while for them to get the hang of it. And also, it took a while bear in mind, Chano Pozo was for most people the first time that the drum that we call the congas, that in Cuba is called the tumbadora, had been seen. It wasn't even permitted to play that drum in public in Cuba until the late 30s. So using it in bands was even a relatively new thing in dance bands in Cuba. It really had only started in the early 40s. But in bringing that instrument into his band and in bringing a figure of such deep root as Chano Pozo, Dizzy Gillespie changed American music. And be assured that every hip musician in the United States was very familiar with what Dizzy was doing with Chano. A lot of jazz historians tended to treat it as some kind of like eccentricity of Dizzy's, but I think it's pretty clear that Dizzy thought it was the most important thing he'd done. You also start to see the bass lines about this time changing to a more Cubanish style of bass line instead of the four on the floor that had been characteristic in the swing era. You start to get this that feeling of the tango bass line, or whatever you want to call it, starts turning up a lot more. But, you know, Chano was a little too street for his own good and got himself killed. And after a very short time, he was not with the Gillespie band very long. Mongo Santa Maria comes in, and probably Mongo Santa Maria is a figure who just gets bigger and bigger as time passes. He did so many things people don't even realize over and over and over again. As the music was happening, he was there. There was also a change that happened between Chano's day and Mongo's day, though it wasn't very long. I mean, Mongo was Chano's friend. So they played together in Havana. Mongo had even played with the great Arsenio Rodriguez in Havana. But a tuning key mechanism was invented for those drums. In Chano's time, you had to tune a conga drum with an open flame. Drummers actually had to bring sterno to the bandstand, and it was pretty cumbersome. But by Mongo's day, a tuning key mechanism had been invented in Cuba, which allowed for more precise and easier tuning of the congas, which also meant you could have more than one on the bandstand more easily. Carlos Papapo Valdez was the guy who really popularized the idea of playing on more than one differently tuned conga at a time. And then, of course, by the 90s, when I recorded Miguel Angadias for a record, he was using five of them tuned beautifully to get this great scale. Mongo was the guy who really popularized the conga in the United States, though. His big hit Watermelon Man in 1963, that was the biggest hit of his career. It was far from the only thing he did. But that was sort of the perfect blend of African-American funky soul style and Afro-Cuban rhythm. After that, you started to see the congas a lot more. By the late 60s, the congas were starting to become omnipresent, and became really almost they became an essential ingredient in African-American music. You can't imagine, think of Ain't Too Proud to Beg without that conga break, or The Last Poets or somebody. But this comes in from Cuba, and Mongo's really the guy who popularized it. Mongo's main audience was African-American. Mongo made his money playing the jazz circuit, playing rhythm and blues covers, not so much playing in the Latin circuit, although Mongo also did more probably than anybody else to promote the idea of recording the traditional classical music of Africa as conserved in Cuba, which he knew very well. His first full-length album was called Chango, Chango is the Yoruba god of masculinity, thunder, and drums. And I like to say it was not only Mongo's first album, it was also Chango's album debut.
1963, Ned Sublette is well into Cuban revolution time. It's still a puzzle to me, a fundamental one. What did music have to do with the revolution, or what effect did the revolution have on the musical culture?
Well, it changed life in Cuba completely, and that affected the music more than anything else. I mean, you know, the changes that happened to Cuban society after 1959 were intense. For the first year or so after Batista fled on January 1st, 1959, things were somewhat normal. And there was a bohemian nightlife in Havana as the cabarets continued to operate. You know, but within a couple of years, the bourgeoisie began to disappear as a class. The record labels, Cuba had developed independent record labels really only in the 50s. The record labels shut down one by one, were nationalized, folded into the one state label. By the revolutionary offensive in the second half of the 60s, even the cabarets shut down, though they later reopened. Some of the bigger names left the country right away, you know, Olga Guillot, Jose Fajardo, Celia Cruz and the whole Sonora Matancera, Bebo Valdez, Rolando La Serie, others gone pretty quick. Thousands more stayed behind. The music industry infrastructure was torn down. There had been 50 dance halls. Now there were three run by the state. You know, the social clubs. There were many social clubs that could house a 5,000-person dance. Well, not the Buena Vista Social Club. I'm thinking of so much as the larger ones, the Galician Club, the big ones. These places had big buildings and could house a 5,000-person dance. Individual Havana neighborhoods had developed their own steps for the style of dancing they called casino. Each barrio had its own way of dancing. And now there was one record label, and productivity got much, much tighter. The rupture was great enough that an entire way of life ground to a halt while a new one very slowly began, right? And along with the professional drain was a demographic revolution. The people who left were overwhelmingly white. By the 70s, Cuban Miami was over 95% white. Most of the members of the Philharmonic left the country. Of course, culture was a priority for the new revolutionary government. I mean, communism was invented by intellectuals, after all, and they badly wanted to have an orchestra. So they advertised in Eastern Europe, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, for string players that could play in the orchestra and teach in the new art school that Cuban children could attend for free, which is how José Luis Cortés, better known as El Tosco, a black kid from Santa Clara who, when he first came to Havana, slept on his flute case in the bus station, wound up becoming an excellent player of Mozart. Without losing his street smarts or his knowledge of the Afro-Cuban religions or he had jazz chops. Whole generation of band leaders learns the basic of music from these European conservatory professionals. Government also starts something called the Escuela de Superación Profesional, a school for professional improvement, where working musicians who never formally studied music could improve their skills studying with the best musicians in Cuba and learn to read music, things that maybe they didn't know how to do. One very important group of the 70s and 80s, Orquesta Ritmo Oriental, had been formed shortly before the revolution. They attended this school for professional improvement together and graduated as a group. By the end of the 60s, something new was starting. Cuba's African heritage is also sort of lurking there. You know, religion is discouraged, but the African heritage was respected as folklore, which provided an acceptable cover for the practice of various African religions. And the music, the first thing that happens, okay, anytime there's a rupture, you know, whether it's the Cuban Revolution or 9/11 or Katrina or anything that drastically changes your life, the first thing you want is to establish continuity with the past. So for the first few years, the music in the new revolutionary Cuba sounded a lot like the older music. The charangas continued. Orquesta Aragon, the great charanga cha-cha-cha of the 50s, probably was at their peak, I think, in the 60s. And they were down with the revolution. They were happy to stay.
Para elegir al mejor, estoy seguro.
slowly new things, new initiatives get going, new styles get going, new artists come to the front. Peo Alafrocan, who is Mongo Santamaria's cousin, who had been an interior decorator before the revolution, came up with something called the Mozambique. Pacho Alonso comes up with Rico Pilon. By the end of the 60s, you're getting somebody like, you get a think tank, first of all, the GRES, which is sort of like the idea was to a government-sponsored attempt to create a new socialist music with songwriters like Pablo Milanés, Silvio Rodríguez, Noel Nicola, Sara González, and also great instrumentals like Emiliano Salvador, Ignacio Barro was part of that group. So you had a like, first-rate band taught by the best music professionals in Cuba, and even the singer-songwriters learned how to read music. And they had a great group, politicized, but a great group. Meanwhile, dance music, which is relatively free from, the dance music was sort of left to its own devices in a lot of ways, content-wise. You know, books and movies, things that could easily become polemical, were scrutinized, I think, a little more tightly than song lyrics, which were considered to be just sort of popular diversion. And songs became a very popular way of Cuba for Cuba to talk to itself. And dance music became an absolutely crucial way for Cuba to keep its spirit going. And in a group called Changui 68, led by a charanguero from Guantanamo named Elio Reve, hired a young bass player and composer named Juan Formel, who left the following year to start Los Van Van. In December 1969, with Los Van Van, I think modern Cuban music really begins. They're still one of the greatest groups in Cuba, now in their second generation. In the early 70s, Irakere. Who's been trying to find a way that they can play jazz. Jazz is, you know, música extranjerizante in the early days, in the 60s and the 70s, was looked down on. You know, the stories of people not being allowed, you know, having to listen to the Beatles clandestinely, having to listen to jazz clandestinely. Irakere gave it a cover by making it, combining it with Afro-Cuban folkloric kinds of music, Afro-drumming, and in the process invented something very valuable. And they came with a tune in 73 called Bacalao con Pan that was the book of Genesis for a style. Between Van Van and Irakere, I really think, a new Cuban music was defined. When I got to Cuba for the first time in January 1990, the first of my 25 legal trips to Cuba, and no illegal ones, I might add. When I first got there, of course, you know, there's this tendency for people who arrive in Cuba to think that Cuba didn't exist before they got there. I've tried not to have that perspective. But what I didn't realize when I got there was that I was seeing the fruit of something that had been growing for decades and was about to explode. And in the early 90s, it did explode with a music that really, after it had peaked, became known as timba. These bands led by these conservatory-trained Afro-Cubans that could read and write music with enormous facility, that could play jazz, that had fantastic ears, that knew all of the Afro-Cuban religious traditions and took all this together and used it to make teenagers dance. Oye, nací en La Habana, soy habanero, Jesús María Belén, y lo sitio entero. Ya tú no sabes que te traigo la rumba de corazón. In bands with 15 members that rehearsed every day, something you can't do in the United States, and had an almost telepathic level of communication on stage.
This became the mark of revolutionary Cuban music, that East German conservatory polish on the traditional Cuban, you say, carnival dance music. Is this what you're talking about?
Yes, the arrival of conservatory professors from Eastern Europe was a very important moment in the remaking of Cuban music after the revolution.
What's the typical sound that we should be hearing to illustrate that point?
In Eje La Banda, Los Sitios Enteros is just a tune that to me defines the early 90s in Cuba. The mambo in that is just as slick as anything you ever heard. The timba wave was, to me, sort of the maximum musical experience I've ever had. I attended at the peak event, the greatest musical event I ever attended in my life anywhere, was in 1997 in Cuba, and was called El Son Más Largo del Mundo. The longest son in the world. The son is the sort of the mother form of Cuban music in the 20th century, and it was the gimmick of it was to set a record for the Guinness Book of World Records. And what they did was in the great outdoor dance hall La Tropical, they had 100 and some Cuban bands. They played nonstop for 5 days and nights. It was kind of like attending a 5-day rave with live music. And from all over the island, the bands were not permitted to stop between numbers. And between the two bands, there was no stop. There were two stages. So there was continuous live music at this great dance hall outdoors for 5 days and nights. There were kids who had stayed there the entire time, sleeping on the concrete floor. Their families would slip them changes of clothes and sandwiches over the fence. By the fourth night, about 1:30 in the morning, these bands were fantastic to begin with, but the audience was so pumped. They were pulling something out of them like I really have never seen before or since.
Tell us about the current generation, Ned Sublett, making new music in Cuba today.
Well, I'm at a bit of a disadvantage doing that. Because although I've been to Cuba 25 times and spent more than 2 years in total on the ground during the years between 1990 and 2003, I haven't been to Cuba since 2003. And I haven't been to Cuba since 2003 because the Bush regime slammed the window down, cut out a good 90% of the limited travel that there was to Cuba. Mm. And this has just been a disaster in terms of cultural interchange and in terms of our ability to comprehend what's going on in Cuba. It's a very, very bad policy, and I'm really disappointed to see that none of the Democratic presidential candidates are promising to take us back even to where we were under Bill Clinton. None of the Democrat candidates has promised to. Neither of the two that are still standing. Chris Dodd wanted to lift the embargo entirely, but I didn't get to vote for him because he'd been voted off the island by the time I got to vote. But neither of the two candidates we have now on the Democratic side have even spoken in terms of restoring academic or cultural exchange. No Cuban musicians played in the U.S. since 2003. Meanwhile, we have the New York Philharmonic going to Pyongyang. And I don't even want to think about what John McCain's policy toward Cuba might be.
What's your best guess about the current vitality of Cuban music?
Cuban music will never stop. It's gone through a lot of changes. And I know that one of the big things that happened... It was already happening. I was there, the longest I was there at a stretch was 6 weeks in 99 and early 2000 at the height of the Elian Gonzalez crisis. Hmm. And from the point of view of already at that point, the peak of timba had passed for a variety of reasons. It was still going on. It's still going on today. But I think its really most vital point was during the depths of the special period when it seemed like the whole world had turned its back on Cuba. And this was the music Cubans used to energize themselves. By 99, with the Elian crisis, something that they did that I think had an unfortunate effect for Cuban music was there was a lot of political talk on the radio and television nonstop. This was the beginning of the so-called Battle of Ideas. And they had the Mesa Redonda, the round table. So where there had been Cuban music on the radio before, and you would turn on the radio and you would get political talk a lot. And this tended to make people tune out the radio. And when they tuned out the radio, they tended to play cassettes. But what happens? In Cuba, you would get your Cuban music from the radio, and cassettes would tend to be more foreign music, stuff that you couldn't necessarily hear on the radio. I mean, they do play non-Cuban music on the radio in Cuba, plenty of it. But, you know, people would tend to put on their tapes of house music or whatever they had. So I think people kind of got out of the habit a little bit and got a little more into music from elsewhere. And you started to, this was about the time that a wave of hip-hop started to get going in Cuba, especially in Havana, much more than in Santiago, which, because of course Havana is a city that looks toward North America and Europe, whereas Santiago looks out toward the Caribbean. In Santiago, they were doing reggae 24/7. This was just before the reggaeton boom. All the time in Santiago, last time I was there in 2003, whereas in Havana, they were doing a kind of hip-hop modeled on the North American style in Spanish with a lot of Cubanisms. Mm. And hip-hop has become, of course, a vehicle for speech. It's subject to some rather different constraints in Cuba than it has been elsewhere. Hip-hop has kind of become a way of testing what you can say, what you can and can't say. Hip-hop in the U.S. kind of consists of saying the impermissible a lot of the time, but in Cuba you really can't say the impermissible because it's not permitted. So it became a way, one subject that you could explore, however. It is possible to criticize things in Cuba. And one of the things you could definitely explore was the whole issue of racism. And that became, I think, a very important subject of hip-hop in Cuba. It's interesting, however, that the Cuban government had gotten a little smarter about how to deal with all of this than they had been back in the days of the Beatles. Abel Prieto, the Minister of Culture, remembered those days very well. And they actually created a state agency for hip-hop, which is presently run by a rapper, a very very with it, a young woman named Magia Lopez, who is part of a hip-hop duo called Obsesión.
Vamos. Yo, la vida se me estruja. Puja, quepo por el hueco de una aguja. Así flaco, igual puedo con un saco.
¿Oíste?
Por la izquierda.
Sale más barato.
Un dato, no mezclar escasez con falta de honradez.
Por lo menos.
Eso trato, me bato everyday con suficiente olfato para no caer en desacato.
Sí.
A no ser que haya maltrato. 4, 5, 6. Hace rato que vengo partiendo todos los acetatos. La letra dice ño cuando hay nada más boniato y arroz. Pero gracias a Dios que tengo siempre algo en el plato.
Ned Sublet, what's the evidence that Fidel Castro had any interest in music at all?
It's really simple. Fidel Castro had almost no interest in music. He's a very non-musical person, which has a lot to do with how Cuban music developed. He had cultural policy. I mean, the famous guiding dictum since 1961 in the Palabras a los Intelectuales was, you know, within the revolution, everything; against the revolution, nothing. But, you know, that wasn't really, you know, explicated in greater detail.
That
and
was for
the
writers,
question was,
man.
Who decides what is within the revolution and what is not? So every Cuban musician, no matter what they do, has become an expert polemicist and can explain how what they're doing is within the revolution. It's kind of interesting, actually. And it hasn't, as far as I can tell, you know, it certainly hasn't prevented Cuban music from saying interesting things. Los Van Van, greatest band in Cuba, started in 1969, still going today. Their lyrics often told stories of life in the street. And if you want to know the history of Cuba in the 70s and 80s, you have to go to Van Van lyrics because they tell you what it was really like. There's a song about standing in a bread line. There's a song about the deal you make with the butcher to get a little more meat. There's all this. And what I realized watching the Cuban songwriters in action was that, Shakespeare, wasn't going to write a play about the court of Elizabeth. But he could write about a 10th century Danish king or something and, ask questions and let people draw their own conclusions. Cuban songwriters tended to ask questions in an interesting and provocative way and let the audience. I always say a Cuban song didn't really derive its meaning till the people had sung it for months. Mm-hmm. So in the absence of any direct involvement by Fidel. I mean, there are a few times where he has said something and something happened. You know, he played a role in promoting Peo el Afrocan when he ran into him in the television studio one day, for example. But really, these examples are fairly minor, in contradistinction to what happened in the Dominican Republic, where a truly evil man, Rafael Trujillo, the dictatingest dictator who ever dictated, in the words of Juno Diaz. People say the one good thing that Trujillo did was to promote merengue. Trujillo was a fanatic merenguero, and he kind of made merengue into the national music of the Dominican Republic.
Hmm. My own takeaway from Cuba in the year 2000, and I went on Chucho Valdez's cue to come and hear the music in its home, was how in the world did we North Americans get into a comprehensive cultural political confrontation with an island where every man, woman, and child can dance like Fred Astaire or better? Or is that what drives us nuts about Cuba?
That's why when I helped Luaca Bop Records put together a compilation that came out in 1991 that was one of the first compilations of post-revolutionary Cuban music that had been heard in this country and by a lot of people around the world, and it was called Dancing with the Enemy.
Mm.
Cuban people aren't our enemy, and they don't think of us as their enemy. Let's dance.
Ned Sublett, it's such a pleasure always to read you and hear you on Cuban music. Long may it pulse, brother.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for spending some time with this wonderful music today.
Ned Sublett, what's the music to go out on to make the point that the magic of Cuban music is here as far as we can imagine?
I think there's nothing better you could go out on than the music of one of the African religions in Cuba. These religions are alive today. They have their musical tradition is really behind everything else that happens in Cuban music. And if you're talking about the music of the Yoruba religion, the Bata music, I think it's the great classical music of West Africa. Its preservation by humble people in great detail in Cuba today is a cultural treasure that's been conserved for the whole world. And I hope that very soon people in the United States will be allowed by their government to visit Cuba and see and hear it for themselves.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation for Open Source at the Watson Institute at Brown University. Please join the ongoing conversation about Cuba and books and ideas and everything else on our website at www.radioopensource.org. You can write me directly by email at chris@radioopensource.org. Thanks for being part of this community of the curious and the expressive at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon.